Sure. Okay. All right now. All right. Welcome everybody. We are beginning our additional. Continuing our series of practical Jewish law in regards to Jewish ethics and business law, and try to share some. I got three more cases, which we will explore together. Happen commonly. So. We're going to ask Shayna from the world of Zoom to read the case number one called Valuable Oldie.
Mr. Yankel Schreiber ran a business dealing in used Sepharim. Each year, he would come to shul on the Yamim Noraim with a new machzor, new for him, but over 100 years old. One Yom Kippur, he came with a machzor that was almost 200 years old, which had been the personal machzor of a Hasidic Rebbe. During the break, he showed it to his friend Eliezer. "How did you get it?" Eliezer asked. "A young fellow with a small kippah on his head walked into the store," Mr. Schreiber replied. "His grandfather had recently died, and he cleaned out the apartment. A few items were antiques, but most were just old stuff that had to be junked." "What about the Sepharim?" asked Eliezer. "There were a few Sepharim in reasonable condition, including this machzor," replied Mr. Schreiber. "The grandson showed it to me and asked what it was worth. I realized this could be a great deal," concluded Mr. Schreiber. "I tried my luck and offered him $500 for the machzor. He said okay and walked out of the store smiling." "How much is the machzor really worth?" asked Eliezer. "He could get at least $1,000 from any dealer," said Mr. Schreiber. "I can sell it to a collector or museum for much, much more." "Show the machzor to Rabbi Dayan," said Eliezer. "He loves old Sepharim." "Gemar chatima tova," Rabbi Dayan greeted Mr. Schreiber. "What new machzor do you have this year?" Mr. Schreiber proudly showed him the machzor and related the story. "It was such an inspiration davening with the machzor of a true tzaddik," he ended.
Okay. So the case is, guy has, and actually they just opened up another one, a person who now I know of two, use farm stores. And what they do is they buy whole libraries in general. And what they do is they, one guy in Mizrahi bookstore in Brooklyn, they'll put all the stuff on eBay, and they make their money based upon, they'll give a person for a price and they'll sell it for $5,000. And they hope to make 10 grand or whatever it is by selling the stuff individually, okay? And you get some fantastic books. Good way to build a, but they opened up one also in Woodmere. And they'll sell this farm, basic books. You want to build your Jewish library, it's a good way. These guys will sell to you, and they'll send it to you directly. But this guy, Mr. Schreiber, guy came in, and he had a machzor, which he did not know had any significance per se. And the guy saw this was like a gem, and he says, "All right, how about $500? And the guy said, "Well, hello, New York." For him, it's like an old book that he would like toss, that he would like, you know, have no purpose for. He did not know. And the guy says it's at least worth $1,000. So let's stop right there. What are the issues at hand? Are you allowed to do that? You could just say, "Hey, you snooze, you lose. And if you have the first mover advantage, you have the knowledge. That's how you make the money. Caveat emptor, right?" Yes. Yes. Clearly did not know. Well, that's the question. I'm presenting that to everybody here on Zoom, and now we have more people here live in the White Room for the first time since COVID began, so that's a win for us. Is that...
Or did he go to that shop because he felt like this is the expert that will give him... I think that actually, that was silly of him, not that any...
Okay, so maybe, but the question is, did Mr. Schreiber do the right thing, or there's no problem? He's fine. Evan is, that's it. That's it. Evan is it. All's love and all. All right, deal's a deal. He offered him cash. He took the deal. He said, I'll pay you $500. He says, sure. He handed him the Moxer. He gave him the $500. Sweet deal. Game over. That's the question. Evan says, no problem. Who says no problem? No problem. What do you say, Suzanne? Okay, not now. Okay, so now, okay. So it's not nice. Okay, what's that? So, all right, so now, first of all, now within not nice, there are two different, is it that so not nice that the sale is not a sale? Does he have to call the guy back and give him the money back? Yeah. Right. Yes. On the other hand, I don't know. See, that's not so clear because the pawn people have the burden of having to unload the thing. And just because you think it's very valuable, I mean, let's say, you know, we're not talking about the extreme, but here's an extreme case. Well, but in this case, does he have to call the guy up and say, I realize that this is worth actually $1,000. Either I'll give it back to you, or I'll give you more money for it. Okay, that, all right?
No, I don't think he could have, but I think he could have been straightforward from the beginning of this is about the real value. If he knew at the time.
Well, he did. It said, he said he knew. He knew. He saw it. Right, so. Okay, it was wrong. Don't do it again. Move on. Okay, Melissa. Now you're like Anna, but is it actually the point that it actually invalidates the transaction? Okay. Not. He was not a good Jew at that moment. Okay. No, he just says, "I'll give you $500 for the safe." He didn't say anything.
Didn't
bargain back. Okay. All right, we're okay, this is a good case. All right, now we'll talk to the Zoom people. Shana, what do you say? What says you?
I say that Sadiqness of the Machzor did not rub off on Mr. Schreiber.
Okay, but so you're voting that's not ethical, but does he have to call the guy back up and undo the sale? What's your feeling here?
The kid didn't know what it was worth. And so Mr. Schreiber, I guess you could say, pulled a fast one on him.
Yeah, took advantage of him.
But I don't know if he would necessarily have to give him more after the deal is done.
Okay, so you're saying he doesn't have to call him again. You're just nervous. He's just like, all right, do better next time. All right, Scott Shapiro, looking very sharp with the tie and white shirt there. I'm very impressed. I feel like underdressed now.
Trying to go senior fellowship.
That's it. Represented there. Okay, good, Scott.
I mean, he took advantage of him. He should give him the balance of the sale, or at least.
Right. So you say you're going like Suzanne. You got to call the person up. You got to tell the dude, by the way, I owe you the money, or I'll give you the money back, and I'll give you
more. Like, maybe take like a little bit of profit, but like he should get a majority of it or something. I don't know.
Okay.
He definitely was taken advantage of.
Okay, we're going to go with Jade. What do you say, Jade?
I feel like he was taking advantage of him. Most people wouldn't know the worth of one of these books if they had them. It's usually sentimental if somebody's given these books.
Right. So, but does he have to call the guy back up to give him more money back? Does he have to call him back and give him another $500 back?
That I don't know the halakha on it. So I don't know.
Okay, fine. All right, we're going to give Mike. You just join us, so you'll hear. So the case is very simply: person goes into a bookstore. He offers a used books, bookseller, buyer, sells it. The guy offers it $500. He takes it. It's actually worth $1,000. Let's continue on in reading it. Okay, Shana, you're reading. Rabbi Dayan furrowed his brow. Hold on, go back up. Go ahead.
Rabbi Dayan furrowed his brow. I'm afraid that your davening this Yom Kippur was tainted, he said sternly. You took advantage of the grandson's ignorance to underpay. which is a violation of the prohibition against ona'a, unfair pricing. I thought ona'a meant overcharging, said Mr. Schreiber. It doesn't make a difference who cheats whom, replied Rabbi Dayan. Just as the seller cheats the buyer if he overcharges, the buyer cheats the seller of a fair price if he underpays. But the whole business of use sefarim is built around this, insisted Mr. Schreiber. I buy whole libraries of use sefarim in the hope that a few of them will turn out to be valuable. Buying a lot blindly is permissible according to many poskim, like any other business gamble, explained Rabbi Dayan. However, since the grandson brought you a specific sefer and relied on your expertise to evaluate it, it is ona'a to pay him much less than it's worth. But there is no real book value for antique items, pointed out Mr. Schreiber. The price depends mostly on how much the buyer desires it. A dealer would pay $1,000, an avid collector would pay $10,000, a museum creating an exhibit of old machzorim might pay $20,000. Yes, for this reason, according to many authorities, there is no ona'a when dealing with antiques, replied Rabbi Dayan. But if any dealer would pay at least $1,000 for the machzor, and he came to you as a dealer, the fair market value would be minimum $1,000. What should I do now? Asked Mr. Schreiber. When there is a clear price differential of more than 1/6, answered Rabbi Dayan, the cheated party is entitled to revoke the sale. Do I have to take the initiative to notify the fellow? Asked Mr. Schreiber. Ona'a is a form of theft, answered Rabbi Dayan. Therefore, you are obligated to return it. You should notify the grandson that the machzor was worth significantly more than $500 and that he can come and have it back. Then you can work out a fair price with him. If the grandson chooses not to come back, you can keep the machzor and assume that he forwent his claim.
All right, so we do not agree with that American principle of buyer beware. Now, you have to, if you are buying something, both buyer and seller have to beware. I cannot take advantage of somebody so by cheating them by 50%. If he's just ignorant and the price is $1,000, and I'm giving him 500 and he's an idiot and he doesn't do any research, can't say, well, he has to take an idiot penalty, call it $500 and say, too bad. No, because the basic principle is Jewish people. And I think this also applies to non-Jews as well, because in the realm of Geneva, to humanity, if you have to have a basic concern, and would you want somebody to do that to you? No. So ona'a is overcharging. He's not allowed to charge $2,000 for that, and he can't only collect $500 from that. Okay, so as he mentioned, there's certain products like services. There is no overcharge because it's something that is it's there's no fixed price. Typically, commodities where there is a fair market value. So, for example, let's say cars. Cars are a good example. Used car. There is a blue book. So within a certain range, let's say a car, the blue book value is 25. So you could charge 26, whatever, because you feel that there's certain features that makes it more. You can't charge it. And you have a guy, an idiot says, I'll pay you $60,000. Now, if you tell him, you know, the blue book value is $25,000, no, I need the car now. Okay, fine. That's fine. He can forego that. If he doesn't want to come back, I'm in Las Vegas right now. It's not worth it. You fly back to your Fatata Sfarim store for the extra $500, you know. That's it, done, okay? Whatever the deal is. So, that's something that we have to be sensitive to. You can't, tragically, I would say, the reputation of a Jewish business person is a shark, a guy who is just a little bit smarter than the next guy and knows 50 ways to take advantage of the other person. That is an unfortunate stereotype, which there are examples of that being true. I'm not going to say that's not true. There are fellow brothers and sisters who are other Jewish people that that take advantage of people. Okay, I did share with you a story a couple of sessions ago where I had a friend of mine in yeshiva, and he went to work as a electronics salesperson at one of those classic, I don't know where it was in New York. At the time, there was a whole cluster of electronic shops back in the 80s. And it was basically a dirty business. Bait and switch, all kinds of, every you name it. Oh, you want the thing, you're not getting the real thing. You're getting the gray market product where there's no guarantee. All kinds of stuff that is like, and the people were Orthodox Jews. So he went to work, he started doing them, basically working out. Basically, he's doing all kinds of, you know, all these kinds of cases every day. It's a different kind of geneva. He goes to our rabbi, Rabbi Israel Chait, the Rosh Yeshiva. What am I doing? You got to quit now. You can't work there. You cannot do that. Your business is cheap. That is not a profession. And it's a tragedy that you know, there are members of our people that view for somehow or another, that's not a problem. Okay? But just as a person, you know, we're not going to get pizza from any place. We're going to get it from Saba's Pizza, by the way, who specifically, just a side point, we specifically got Saba's Pizza tonight, which is not our normal vendor, because tragically, they were the victim of an anti-Semitic attack. They, on Sunday morning or Monday morning, they received a large brick through their front.
Rabbi Pinney, you broke up. I couldn't hear what you said. Unfortunately, the Zoom broke up as you were saying Saba's.
Okay, so I'll repeat it again. So we specifically, the dinner tonight is from Saba's Pizza on the east side. We typically get from Cafe Roma, both fine places. But we went specifically, it was sponsored today by somebody who wanted to specifically give business to Saba's Pizza because they were victimized tragically for an anti-Semitic incident where a large brick was thrown through their glass door, and I know the evidence that it was a hate crime. Upper East Side. This is, you know, how it says 10 minutes, that's a 10 minute Uber right away. So that's that. So, okay, that's case number one. We go on to case number two. All right, let's see here. I'm gonna have the people on Zoom read because everybody here can hear you loud, but the only people can hear me speak is just me. So we're going to do that way. All right. So, Michael, can you read? Michael.
Driving.
Well, in other words, here's an example. This is an example where, according to American law, he did nothing wrong. Why do we mean?
I don't
want to be relevant. Okay, fine. You can do. I notice that you can't really disagree with a myth from the Torah. The Torah says you can't overcharge. I think we should overcharge. Well, it's very nice. No, he's not giving it. Let me clarify. He's giving an application. There is, in the Torah, an open pasuk of Lo Tonu, which we did it actually a couple of weeks ago. So there's two verses in actually Parsha Bahar. Lo Tonu et Amisach, you should not afflict your fellow Jew. One affliction is financial affliction, overcharging or underpaying. That's point number one. And the other one is verbal affliction. We've done that case. So that's a open Mishnah. It's not some Jews do that. Some Jews observe that. Now that every person has to aspire to keep that. It's not really subject to debate. Person can say, I don't keep that. I don't keep Shabbos. I don't keep this. So fine. Well, yeah, a person can pick what observers are going to do. I mean, Okay. So that's it. So, yes, question. All right, so, yes, Melissa. Okay. Well, Rabbi Denno, this, by the way, this, I've gotten these three cases from the Business Halach Institute. The author of that, Rabbi Meir Orlian, he writes that they bring it to Rabbi Dayan Diamond as a judge, an expert in Jewish business law. No, this is a made-up case. I don't know where Orlean. I don't know him personally. Okay. Right. So we have, of course, the famous General Moshe Dayan of the IDF, but Dayan is a common name, Sephardic name, correct? But they're using it as a tongue-in-cheek to bring it to a person who knows about these particular cases. All right, Dave, Michael. from LA. You with us? Can you read?
I'm with you. I'm driving, so I can't read.
I'm going to add to that. Michael, don't read, please. Keep your eyes on the road and your hand upon the wheel, as you made for the song. Okay, I will read this one, and then we'll go back to the Zoom people. The title is Timber. Sukkot was a few days away. Many people had already built their sukkahs. Mr. Ryan went to the backyard to begin building. Our tree grew a lot this past year, he said to his wife. Will it interfere with the sukkah, she said. Mr. Ryan looked up at the tree. Yes, one of the branches goes over the sukkah and covers a big part of it. So that's, by the way, you cannot get shade. The shade of the sukkah has to come from the schach. Schach needs to be something that is no longer a natural branch or bush or whatever, but it was no longer attached to the ground. Therefore, you can't be getting shade from the overhang of the branch. Can you cut the branch? Mrs. Ryan asked. It will be hard for me, said Mr. Ryan. I don't have the proper equipment. However, our neighbor, Mr. Green, likes gardening. He has a chainsaw and can do it easily. I'll ask him. The following evening, Mr. Green came out to cut the branch. Under the tree was some lawn furniture. He moved it aside, climbed the tree. Watch out, he called down as he began cutting. When the tree was almost cut, it broke off, twisting as it fell. It hit another branch, bounced off, and crashed to the ground 15 feet away. One end landed on a lawn chair and cracked it. Mr. Green came down from the tree. I'm sorry about the lawn chair, he said. I'll buy you a new one. That's not necessary, I replied, Mr. Ryan. It's not your fault. That branch fell in that way. I damaged a chair, though, insisted Mr. Green. In any case, it wasn't new, said Mr. Ryan. Well, it was still usable, argued Mr. Green. You can't fix it, so in any case, you're going to have to buy a new one. Let's take it up with Rabbi Dayan, Mr. Ryan suggested. Must I pay Mr. Ryan for his lawn chair? Mr. Green asked Rabbi Dayan, and how much? What do you guys say? Yes, pay anything? Yes, no, how much? No, but he's asking the thing about how much, he's asking the question, how much Mr. Ryan is, must I pay Mr. Ryan for his lawn chair? He's asked a question. Is he obligated? He can do whatever he wants over and above that, but what is the what is the legal minimum? Does he have to pay for the lawn chair? Why not? Okay, that's a strong argument. He wasn't negligent. He did a reasonable thing, but due to a freak act of nature, the large branch bounced off and catapulted and smashed the lawn chair. Well, it's not his fault. Okay, there we have it. Okay, so you say he's off the hook.
Oh,
yeah, both elements. Anna. I'm not saying you don't know. We don't know. Don't get prejudiced. So let's say the lawn chair, new is $50. In its current state, it's $25. He should pay, he's obligated to pay $25 for the chair. Okay. Suzanne. You like Anna. Okay. Evan. What do you say, Evan? No, but Melissa just said, he didn't just have a chair right here and then just, went wildly with his chainsaw. He moved the chair away a decent amount, and lo and behold, it had an unfortunate turn of events. $25. He has to pay the cost. He has to pay the cost of the value of the lawn chair the moment before it got crushed. Okay. That's a good question. Is it the repair? By the way, he cracked it. Doesn't specify. Cracked it. Okay. All right. So, Shana, what says you?
I like Dana's answer.
Okay. All right. So you say he's obligated to pay for the value of the used chair prior to its being crushed.
Okay. I think because if we're talking halachic minimums, even though he took all necessary precautions, I still think as a minimum, he has to give some sort of reimbursement.
Okay. Now, the fact is that he wasn't paid to do this. He was doing, by the way, nobody says, hey, Mr. Green is coming over there and helping him out as a friendly neighbor. He's not getting paid for this. Nobody's given that as an F factor. He's being the friendly neighbor. And duty of care. He showed some duty of care. For those reasons, he should be off the hook. He acted a reasonable person. He took proper precautions. Okay. Michael Savitsky, even though you're driving, you can still answer. What do you say? What does he got to pay? Nothing? What do you say?
I think he has to pay the minimum value of what it was before he crushed it.
Okay,
you're even though it was accidental.
Everybody's getting on the Anaheim stream. Okay, that's a good question. All right, Jade, what says you, Jade? What do you think? Get the guess.
I'm not sure. I want to hear other people's opinions.
Okay, all right, here we go. So, must I pay Mr. Ryan for his lawn chair, Mr. Green, asked Rabbi Dayan, and how much? Well, did Mr. Green pay you for your services? Rabbi Dayan asked. He did. Did Mr. Green pay you for his services? One second, that doesn't make sense. I think it's a typo. I think did Mr. Ryan pay you for your services? One second, did he say about payment? I don't know. I don't see any payment. That changes the facts. Hold on one second. Hold on one second. Bait and switch over here. Let's see.
Is he under oath?
All right, no, okay. Did Mr. Ryan pay for your services? He did, replied Mr. Green. Does that make a difference? It might. The Gemara in Baba Kama addressed the case of a shochet, a slaughterer, who slaughtered, but the shechita was determined to be pasul. There are different ways that an animal can end up being not kosher. Either A, they do a proper slaughtering and they open up the animal, and there is, for example, there are internal diseases that it would not live a year. So, for example, they take out the lung, they blow it up, and if there are certain kinds of punctures or cancerous growth, then they say it's what they call a trefa. Trefa means literally ripped. Okay, so it has internal diseases. Trefa means internal diseases which will not, which illness will not allow it to live for more than a year. They feel they have the YouTube video, which I'm not going to share with everybody, but I'll share it with you. It is really gross. Okay, so I'll share that with you, but not for everybody else. You could. Okay, fine. All right, so. Look, you're having. There's a huge difference. You have no right to get on the vegan train if you're a mere vegetarian. Okay. Anyways, but another way is that if he does it improper slaughter, he can mess up the animal. He's negligent. Okay. We'll go into why that is. Okay. The shochet who was paid is liable for the animal. One who was not paid is exempt. Okay. So, if you're paid to do the job, interestingly enough, and you mess up, and this animal, a huge cow, was probably, I don't know, $3,000 worth, I don't know, thousands of dollars. If you basically rendered this animal not kosher because you did a poor job, you did not do a duty of service, you didn't provide duty, then you have to pay. But if you did it if you're not paid, you're exempt. Similarly, the Mishnah teaches that a paid craftsman who is entrusted with an item to work on is considered a shomer sacharan. He's a paid watchman. He is liable for theft and loss and exempt only for onus, circumstances beyond his control. So, for example, you drop off your dress or suit at the tailor or at the dry cleaner, and they have a fire. Technically, if it was beyond their control, they would be technically exempt because they did it was beyond their control. we have insurance now, but from a but if they were negligent and then they left the door open and people came and stole all the clothing, then you'd have you could collect on your loss. No, so he's saying that there are different levels. There are different levels of what's called shmirah, of being a watch person, so a guardian. So if you're paid, if you're a craftsman, you have the shomer chinam is the basic level. Shomer sachar is a paid watchman. You have a higher duty of guardianship, and if it gets lost, you have to pay for it. Only if onus, if it wasn't your fault, then you're off the hook. Negligence, even the shomer chinam is free guardian. He did everything but theft happens. Okay, so then I thought that a person who damages is always liable, said Mr. Ryan, even in case of onus. Let me explain what that means. Let's say, for example, the general rule is if you damage in Jewish law, Adam, here's a phrase that pays. It's important, this is a very important thing. Adam mu'ed li'olam ben meshogim ben mezik ben er ben yashin ben ones. A person, in regards to damage, is always viewed as being a mu'ad. A shor mu'ad means a damaged creature. Whether you do it on purpose, by accident, you were asleep, you were awake. So therefore, for simple example, you're sleepwalking, you knock something over. Or let's say there was a person has designer glasses, sunglasses on your couch. You're sitting next and you fall asleep and you doze over and you turn over and you crush them. You have to pay. You're always high. Without negligence. No, even if that's it, you're always chayv. If you do damage, you're always chayv. Now, if the person while you're asleep put the glass there, then it's on them. Okay, but if it was there when you were awake,
you weren't there.
But you fell asleep and you rolled over onto them. That's it.
Even if the ninja came and injected you and then fell on top of them, you would still be
lying. Yeah, but yes, you're always chayv. Always high.
What if some children?
Okay, well then you're dead. The state would be, they can make a claim against your state. I don't know about that case. All right, so he's arguing back. So Mr. Ryan is saying that I thought he's always chayv. Mishnah says, Tosfos explains that a person is liable only if he carries some element of blame, even if he's not negligent. Onus ke'ein aveda. A paid person, paid worker, carries additional liability as long as he could have prevented the loss. Ones ke'ein k'neiva, with extra care. Even a paid worker, though, is not liable for damage completely beyond his control. Ramban is more stringent. He maintains that one who damages is liable regardless of the circumstance, unless the owner was remiss in allowing the damage. He concedes that a worker who acted upon instruction is not liable for circumstances beyond his reasonable control. What about our case? Circumstances were not beyond control, since one could have moved the chairs farther away, said Rabbi Dayan. Thus, as a paid worker, you are liable. There could have possibly also been an element of blame, so even had you not been paid, you could have been liable. How much money should I pay? You are not liable for a brand new chair, only the value of the broken one, replied Rabbi Dayan. The chair should be evaluated as worth when you broke it. Which would depend on how old it was, probably based upon the expected years of usage and in what condition. Basically, what Suzanne said. Basically, if the chair was assessed $25, since it's viewed as even if he's a paid worker to cut the branch, it's considered not beyond his control. He could have moved. He could have been a little less. There's a category. He's not negligent here. But it's not onus. Onus means completely beyond your control. It was within his control. He could have, instead of moving the chair here, he could have moved it another 10 feet.
What is the origin of responsibility? Like this control thing, it seems to just be So you're saying that you're strictly liable if you could have even if you were in that
Here's the two case. If you're paid, in other words, essentially what we call in America, this is basically malpractice. You know, right? You are paid to do something. Right. You are paid to do something, and during your time, whether you are a craftsman or you're a showfit or you are hired to cut trees, during that time, because of your efforts, it caused damage. Basically, you're always chayev unless it's absolutely beyond your control. Yeah.
Well, we're talking about something flawed.
So he's saying that you're always high.
Why is strict liability only if you can prevent it? If you cannot prevent it, then you're not strictly liable.
No, it's very simple. If you could not have prevented it, you're exempt.
You're not liable.
At all.
It, yes. Then you're liable, even if you weren't negative.
Correct. It's a very high threshold. Okay. Jewish law and American law are not identical. The level of care that you have to have for other people's possessions is actually quite high. Well, we have to define it. The question is, if he's saying if it's not, they're defining what is ones, what is anything which is what is negligence, not ones is negligence. That means beyond your control. If it's within your control, you're defined as negligent.
That's how the word is used. Negligent means a reasonable person would have done X and you came short. So this isn't ordinary negligence. This is, you could have prevented it even though you weren't negligent, you're still responsible because you could have prevented it. No one's saying that you should have.
No. So that's why he's differentiating that even according to many that a person who did it as a favor that when you become a paid worker to do something, you are accepting a responsibility, a higher level of responsibility on the item that you're working on, A, and B, and therefore something happens to it, you're going to have a hive versus differentiating. Even if you, as long as it's not onus, you're hive. Exactly. And versus a case where, as he's saying, that if you did it as a favor, then he wouldn't honestly be chayav for that. Yes. Unless he didn't move the chair at all.
Even as a favor, you're still liable.
I want to make sure, if he did not even do a basic level of care, then he's chayav. Because that's true for any, if I damage anything from any other person, if I open the door and I didn't really, and I misjudged how close the car was in the supermarket parking lot, right, and I bang into the door and I have a nice gesunte scratch in the guy's Lexus, then you're chayav. I did that. I told you that story, right? I told you that story. No, how I did that, and the guy wrote a note, and then I had to put in the note, and the guy showed up. He could have maybe driven this car maybe 12 miles from the showroom, and it was like, it was a Mercedes. It was like a worker. It had like one of those like really deep, robust. It was like, and I just said, I'm sorry. Here's my insurance information. I totally apologize. He didn't say too many words to me, but he didn't shoot me, which was helpful. That was helpful. I was going for the not being shot in the parking lot. That was it. And, good times. Good times. What I'm sharing with you guys is that obviously what you're seeing is that a change of a variable can change the law. That's true for all law. But what I'm trying to sensitize, that what I'm trying to do is do two things. A, build your intuition about when is a problem, point number one. And two is to become understanding that Jewish law and American law are not identical. Actually, the responsibility of a Jew is actually higher. Can you know, we can't overcharge, we can't underpay, we can't do it. And if damage results from our cause, it's attributed to us, and we have to take care of that. Okay, all right. Let's go on to our third case. Let me have Shane again read it all out. Okay, fine, good. The goal here is to continue. Yes, was a question. So again, they don't. I have the same facts as you do. I don't know. I mean, apparently he could have. Obviously, because when Rabbi Dayan said, "Well, you could have moved it further," he says, "No, I couldn't. There's no place to go." He didn't say that. So I assume that there was. He thought he just gave it a normal. Let's say the distance of where the branch was underneath the tree, and he just extended beyond that, and he didn't factor out that the thing could have a bouncing factor. Let me ask you the most basic question. I turn over on the couch and I crush the person's glasses. I'm asleep. I knew there were glasses. How about this? How about if I put my, let's say there is a, I think you are, yes. 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 Wow. Huge dog, wow. No, if you're negligent, that you that's it. It's your you lost. You can't. In other words, you can't. Right, you're the. In other words, the case is this interesting case. I'm watching the dog. I'm responsible that the dog does not do damage. But let's say the damage does damage to my own stuff. Can I now? But then was it a lack of your guardianship of the animal that they ate that you have no claim to that person? I don't know. No, I'm just saying that. Okay. Let's take this sleep. Well, I have to double check this, but my understanding is if you are sleepwalking, you are chayef. What we said that was. So you saw that, by the way, that was a Tosos one.
You're going to be criminally liable for your actions, even though you're wasted, because you should have known that by getting so drunk, you might have done what you did.
So let me just go back to this phrase here that explains that the general case that you're chayv even for ones, even beyond your control. But the Tosos limits it. He says the person is liable only if he carries some element of blame, even if not negligent. Ones ke'ein aveda. A paid worker carries additional liability as long as he could have prevented the loss with extra care. Even a paid worker, though, is not liable for damage completely beyond his control. So we have to, that's where we have to define what is considered beyond his control. When is there a measure of blame? That's where there's a, but basically, if there is a.
Cause versus proximate. Proximate cause means, yeah, I caused it. Proximate cause means, was it foreseeable that my actions were going to result in that? I think that's really the main issue. You can be a but-for cause in a freak accident, and no one would have ever foreseen.
Right. So that if it's what the Tosos is arguing, if you're completely, it's a machlokas rishonim, by the way. It's not so simple because generally, the general rule is very simple. If there is damage and you are the cause of the damage, you're chayav. That but-for cause. That's it. It's clear cut. You are the damage resulted from your from you.
Direct
contact. Correct. That's it. It's a very, and it's a high standard. It's a high standard. Okay. Let me just want to do. I want to slip into the third case, deposit payment. All right, Shayna, take it away.
Mr. Zemmer led a popular band. One day, Mr. Klausner called him. Be'ezrat Hashem, we're making a wedding after Purim, and I'd like to book your band, he said. It's a couple of months away, but I'd like to reserve the date. I'll put it on my calendar, said Mr. Zemmer, but I require a 10% deposit to reserve the date. You can give me a check or make a transfer. Mr. Klausner transferred the money. A week later, Mr. Klausner called. I'm sorry, but I'd like to cancel the booking, he said. What happened? Asked Mr. Zemmer. A change in wedding plans? No, replied Mr. Klausner. We decided to go with another band. You can't do that, replied Mr. Zemmer. We already reserved the date. But I haven't signed a contract yet, objected Mr. Klausner. As far as I'm concerned, once we reserve the date and you make a deposit, the deal is sealed, argued Mr. Zemmer. It's not ethical. I'm not getting into a question of ethics, said Mr. Klausner. I have valid reasons for canceling. Until we sign a contract, the agreement is not binding. At most, you can keep the deposit money. After agreeing and paying a deposit, the deal is sealed, insisted Mr. Zemmer. I'm going to sue you for breach of contract. What contract, retorted Mr. Klausner? There isn't any. I'm willing to discuss the issue with Rabbi Dayan. If he says that I can't retract after paying a deposit, I'll leave the booking. What do you say? I'm okay with that, said Mr. Zemmer. The two came to Rabbi Dayan. We booked a date, said Mr. Zemmer. Can Mr. Klausner retract after paying a deposit?
I think I please that. Have it get first bid. So it's not a deposit is not a contract. Right. They went shopping elsewhere. Right. But so you agree with Mr. Klausner that basically no contract was signed. No, there's no contract here. That's it. You got the deposit. That's it. You agree? You don't feel so comfortable about that. All right. Okay, yes, Anna. Fully for the whole contract. Wow, for the whole band. Wow. Okay, Melissa. And binding. So you go with Anna. Too easy. Okay. Okay. All right, Shane, what do you say?
If I remember correctly, we're several months out from this wedding.
We are.
So I think the timeline may have something to do with it as well, because it would give Mr. Zemmer time to book another event if we're multiple months out, as opposed to him canceling like the day before or the week before.
Okay, that's an important variable. Okay, we'll see if that's material or not. Deposit is positive or not. Yeah, very good.
So I would say worst case, he's out, or Mr. Klausner is out the money of the deposit, but I don't think there's a full contract. And I think that the amount of time plays into it as well.
Okay. All right, Michael, what do you say?
Deposit is gone. That's it.
And but he has no other further claim on the guy.
That's right.
Okay, let's go. All right, Shayna, you're reading on.
Just as kinyanim, acts of acquisition, serve to finalize a sale, they serve to finalize a rental or hiring of services, said Rabbi Dayan. Many authorities maintain that payment of money serves as a kinyan to finalize a hiring. Why is that? Asked Mr. Klausner. All hiring is essentially renting a person's services, explained Rabbi Dayan. Although Chazal annulled payment of money as a kinyan for purchase of movable items, some maintain that it remains a kinyan for rental, even of movable items. The same is true for hiring, which is rental of the person's services. Furthermore, the Gemara Kedushin teaches that people are compared to real estate, continued Rabbi Dayan. Thus, just as money is a valid kinyan for real estate, it is a valid kinyan to acquire the person for his services. Would paying a partial deposit also indicate intent to confirm the booking, asked Mr. Zimmer. There is a dispute regarding the intent of a deposit, replied Rabbi Dayan. Some maintain that the intent of a deposit is indeed to confirm the rental or hiring, whereas others maintain that the intent is merely to serve as a non-refundable penalty for retracting. This can vary with time, period, and location, and the context of the down payment. What about nowadays, asked Mr. Klausner. Nowadays, a deposit, often called earnest money, is usually not viewed as binding until a contract is signed, answered Rabbi Dayan. The Gemara teaches that in places where it is customary to sign a contract, payment of money alone does not confirm a real estate acquisition. Rima qualifies that for rental, money suffices, since there is less insistence on a contract, but the common practice nowadays in many places is not to consider a rental binding until a contract is signed. Thus, concluded Rabbi Dayan, if it is customary to view the deposit only as a penalty or to insist on a contract, Mr. Klausner can retract even after paying a deposit.
Okay. So this is where actually American business practices would be critical. In other words, it all depends on what is the assumption of the consumer. If in America, the practice that a deposit is just earnest money, that I intend to do it, but it's not a signed contract, as you guys said, you got your deposit money. You're not getting the non-refundable deposit money, but there's no contract here. Game over. And they don't, and he owes them nothing. But if in fact, and I don't know what that means, we're a lawyer now, so, you know, if it's in fact the payment of a deposit is de facto a contractual obligation, which I doubt that is, then he would be obligated to follow through on the entire contract. I don't know what the So let's make it in real numbers. Let's say the band was $10,000 and you put down $1,000.
Right. So usually down payment deposits are when you rent an apartment. You have a certain amount of money so that if you damage property, the landlord can sort of pay for that. So in that context, the security deposit is, and in other contexts, is liquidated damages. Which means if there's a breach of the contract, I'm going to use this money to offset the damages. However, a deposit can also be, like you said, like an initial booking before being binded to a contract. And I think in real estate, sometimes you...
So that's in real estate and in a renting of an apartment. So let's say I hand I think it's very rare for a person to hand the person money without a signing of the contract because for that very reason, because I want to make sure my deposit actually is going to be.
I mean, an acquiring.
Or buying property.
Pay deposit or you finalize.
But there'll be some at least initial contract probably.
Right. And so through here, there's some major promises.
Yes.
I promise that I'm going to pay money in the future.
Yes.
In addition to this deposit. You promise me that you're going to perform.
Yes.
Able to the detriment of both.
Right.
Because they both had opportunity costs, things that they could have pursued, but didn't because they had the expectation that this was going to take place. So that's an exchange of promises.
So if it was done by an American law, what can Mr. Zemer say you owe me the full 10 grand?
Yes.
Wow.
There was an exchange of promises, future promises.
Wow.
But I promise to do something for you in the future. You promise to do something for you.
I mean, verbal offers all the time.
Well, verbal offers, we already did a couple of cases ago. Verbal offers are not legally binding. You're just going to be a mechusar amuna. It's like you're not a trustworthy person.
Yeah, this is not an offer. This is
something. Right. And also with a deposit. So again, this is a case where we'd have to investigate it, go by industry. You know what I'm saying? So you'd have to check out in the music or party industry, what is the thing? If a person gives a deposit, typically a deposit often comes in with the signed contract to avoid this problem. That's why, by the way. Correct. And once they send you that sign, no, everybody's clear. Once the contract's signed and they give you the deposit, You're locked in and they're locked in. You're locked in. Here was the case, and this happens sometimes. The guy gave the money. There was a verbal commitment, and they did not get down to the. By the way, I want to share with you that these circumstances of the problems happen when contracts are not presented, when expectations are not clarified. Even if it's an email, disputes always come. When everything. Right when things are fine, like we had the case by there where there's a roommate. We had the case of the they want to move out and they have to severance there. Right, exactly. So when things are good, there's no problem. Everybody is sure, no problem. Everything's good. It's when things go bad, and they will eventually go bad. That's why you want to avoid getting to these murky situations where you get the money and you don't get the contract, this and that. And then you have to go into what is the common practice in this thing? If that's really, is it really a just a way to hold the date, but it's not really obligating them to, not obligating anybody really?
The question is, what is the deposit? Is it an initial payment? Is it something that's there in case of damages? Is it liquid? Now, deposit can be many different things. It can be an initial payment. It can be just the money to reserve tentatively.
Right. Or is it really just really a penalty for retracting?
Right.
So if he's saying, in order, it's not a contract, but if you're not going to follow through with this, in order, that's how I think it's in this particular business. In other words, I'm giving you $1,000, which you're going to lose if you don't actually get to the date actually filling out the contract. Right. It basically was really that. I think that in this particular, yeah. So basically, you're not absolutely binded, but it will be $1,000 worth of pain if you don't follow through and sign the contract. Yes. Yes, that's what it is. That is one possibility. Another possibility is no. He is actually there's a firm agreement here, and he's paid one installment of a binding agreement, and that will be subject to industry and circumstance. And that's
based on American law.
Okay, fine. Okay, so that's it. So look, we've done a total of. All right. Well, we'll get there's all kinds of complexity. We've done together, I've given you basically, we've had three sessions. We've done 9 cases in different common areas, deposits, damages, all kinds of stuff. So I'm just giving you sort of like a little pace group. So I'm thinking we could have, so I'm going to turn off the recording for the time being.